The enemy is inside our heads. You know, nobody has ever said worse things about us than we've said about ourselves. So when you see somebody overcome that, it's very powerful. And that's why I do the work that I do in the nonprofit sector, because I think the nonprofit sector has been sold a bill of goods that keeps them thinking very small. And I just love liberating people from that and opening their eyes to the notion that there is zero reason you can't dream as big as Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk.
Welcome to Crazy Good Turns. I'm your host, Frank Blake, and our guest is Dan Pallotta. Dan defies easy description unless you just want to use a string of superlatives. He's an accomplished entrepreneur, an author, a humanitarian activist, and I suspect most of you have heard of him. If not, I encourage you to watch his TED Talk explaining why the way we think about charity is dead wrong. If you watched it, watch it again. It is brilliant. It is one of the most viewed TED Talks of all time. And I think that there's no one, I mean truly no one, who has given more creative thought, more energy to the idea of Crazy Good Turns than Dan. So it's going to be a great privilege to talk with him and learn about how he thinks about doing good for others. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Frank. It's a privilege to be with you.
Great. Dan, I'd like to start with an observation you once made. You said service is not doing something for nothing or suffering economically or not being paid. It's really having the humility to respond to what life seems to be asking you to do and to respond to what seems to be your natural calling. What was the first thing you felt life was calling you to do?
Be an NHL goalie.
That's great.
I desperately wanted to be a goalie in the NHL. I played hockey during the time of Bobby Orr. You know, I was 7 or 8 years old when he was in his early 20s and in his prime, and I just wanted to be an NHL goalie. And I went to Catholic school, and I would pray to God. I said, please, 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 if you let me be an NHL goalie, even if we're playing out of town, no matter where it is, on a Sunday, I'll find a church, I'll go to church. So that's what I felt was my calling the first time around.
My first calling was to be a guard for the Boston Celtics, so we shared that.
and it wasn't meant to be, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And then I, you know, my dad was a construction worker, but he got involved in volunteering for this campaign for a guy running for the state Senate in Massachusetts, and I got interested in politics, and of course, you know, I was born in 1961, so it was the era of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy and Apollo. It was kind of a magical time for possibility and leaders who were talking about possibility. And I thought, you know, that's what I want to do. I want to be president of the United States. And I had a path, you know, I'm going to run for school board, and then I'm going to run for state Senate, and then governor. And then from there, you can run for president. And that was in the early, late 70s and the early 80s. I'm gay. There were no out politicians at that time. And as I began to realize that I was gay, that dream went sailing far away, you know. And so I drifted for a while. You think about it, we tell kids, find the thing you're passionate about, find the thing you're passionate about. But we don't have we don't have any advice for kids who find the thing they're passionate about, and then society says, yo, you can't do that.
And so what was a turning point that got you focused in a different direction?
You know, I guess I went to college. I started studying development economics. I started learning about the massive mortality associated with hunger in the world. You know, 20 million people dying every year, most of them kids, most of it diarrhea. And I just hadn't been exposed to the scale of that suffering in my middle-class upbringing in Melrose and Malden, Massachusetts, and I decided I wanted to do something big about that. So I organized a bike ride across America when I was in college. 39 of us rode our bikes across America to raise money and awareness for Oxfam America, and it was a very powerful journey and a very powerful, daunting experience, but a powerful experience. And so then as my life went on and the AIDS epidemic came along, I thought, the AIDS community needs something more than red ribbons and Saturday morning fun walks. It needs some kind of an epic journey for people to express their love and their grief and their passion. And so we created the AIDS Rides, which were, you know, long, arduous journeys, 7 days long, sometimes across Alaska, across Montana, down the coast of California. Then we created the Breast Cancer 3-Day Walks, which were these long marches that lasted 60 miles in 3 days. So that's kind of the chain of events from wanting to be a goalie to ending up in the center of philanthropy and giving.
So I've read that over, I guess, about a decade, nearly 200,000 people have participated in multi-day charity events your company has created. Do you have some favorite stories of participants being changed by walking or riding for days at a time in your events?
Oh, yeah. That was part of what was beautiful about it, with a story after story after story. See, we didn't market the AIDS Rides or the Breast Cancer 3 Days to athletes or to cyclists, which was counterintuitive. We didn't want some testosterone-driven competitive experience. We wanted a beautiful experience of community and struggle and journeying together. So, you know, we advertised in the mass media, which meant we got the most motley crews of people doing these events, you know, rear ends of all dimensions and breathing capacities of all types and ragtag cycling outfits. And that's what made it beautiful. There was this one incredible woman named Susan Silverman who was going to do the first Twin Cities to Chicago AIDS Ride. She was out training one morning, got hit by a drunk driver, had to have the lower half of her left leg amputated. And, I went and saw her in the hospital on the day of the closing ceremonies, and she said, next year I'm going to do all 5 of the AIDS Rides. And she did. There was a woman who was a psychotherapist, never raised a dime in her life for charity. She's now raised over $1 million for breast cancer, year after year after year, participating in these multi-day breast cancer events. My mom and my dad, you know, my dad, when he was 64 and we announced that we were going to do the Montana AIDS vaccine ride across the Continental Divide in Montana, you know, he said, I've been a construction worker. I always wanted to do something to make a difference in people's lives, and this is it. I want to do this. And so, you know, he spent a year training by himself on the little roads around Malden, Massachusetts, and at the age of 65, crossed the Continental Divide twice with me. My mom's a breast cancer survivor. She and my two sisters walked in the breast cancer 3-day from Worcester to Boston. And when we got to the closing ceremony, her mother was there waiting for her, and she said, Patsy, I'm so proud of you. And my mother said that's the first time she ever heard her mother say that. So the experience lived on that level of sort of spirituality and emotion. Yes, we were doing it to raise money, and we raised more money than anybody ever had more quickly. But the real power was an emotional power, kind of a spiritual power, and that's where I always kept my, that was the prize I always kept my eyes on, is to make sure that we weren't diminishing that in any way.
You know, I love, there's a phrase you use within your company of human period, kind period, be both. And you actively encourage people to experiment, as you say, outrageously with kindness. What's outrageous kindness to you?
Yeah, that was a great line that our creative director, Rex Wilder, came up with. What experimenting rigorously with kindness means for me is stepping out of your embarrassment and stepping out of your habits and doing something creative and delightful for someone else. So, you know, what we told people on the AIDS Rise is, help someone fix their flat tire, even though you know the dinner line is going to get longer. You see someone dragging a heavy duffel bag across camp, offer to help them, even though that little voice in your head is saying, well, I brought a light duffel bag. Why the hell should I help them if they brought a heavy one? Or help someone set up their tent if you see them having trouble with it. And people just took us up on that in a big way, and they started to get really creative with it, you know, going into town and buying big boxes of popsicles and bringing them back for everybody coming in on the finish line, dozen people around someone with a flat tire. So you had trouble fixing the flat because there were so many people there asking you if you wanted to help. You know, we live in this rat race, right? Where And we're all afraid that we're going to get left behind. And I think that makes us very anxious and very desperate, and we forget about love and enthusiasm and connection because we're so afraid that we're going to get left behind. And kindness, building community of kindness, helps to mellow that a great deal, you know?
And is your learning over time that we need events to pull this out of us, and does it stay when it's pulled out, or that it's capable to find outside of extraordinary events?
I still get letters from people saying, you know, I did the AIDS ride 20 years ago, and it made such a huge difference in my life. It changed the course of my life. So I think those kinds of experiences open people's eyes to a possibility. It's easy to forget, which is why I think, you know, we have so many things that are habitual in our lives. We floss our teeth habitually, you know, we eat habitually, we make our beds habitually, but we don't visit the spiritual side of our lives habitually. We don't visit kindness habitually. And I've been in a 12-step program for a long time, and part of the reason 12-step works is I go every week, you know, and I think in business, in the world, you know, people do a workshop one day and they think it's going to last the next 30 years, or a company brings in a facilitator to do some work on their culture one day, and 2 years later the culture has disintegrated and they blame it on the workshop. You know, well, you never did anything to keep it alive.
Yeah, the habit point is such a huge point. And you talk a lot about the potential of people and the potential of society. What do you push in terms of getting people to discover their own potential?
You know, you can't give in to their self-talk, and you can't let them give in to their self-talk.
That's a great phrase. What do you mean?
So we have this little voice in our heads that's been talking to us ever since we could understand English, and it's typically pretty punishing, you know. And it tells us you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you're not capable of achieving your dreams. That's for someone else. And you know, so when we started the AIDS ride, we set a mandatory pledge minimum of $2,000. You had to raise $2,000 in order to go on it. And you had to go the whole 7 days. You had to go this whole 600 miles. You had to sleep in a tent every night. And up until then, these Thon events welcomed people with open arms, no matter how much or how little they had raised, which was nice and democratic, but it wasn't a very powerful revenue model. And some people said, well, that's discriminatory. You know, some people can't afford that. And my feeling was, you know, the harder it is for people, the more powerful the experience is going to be. So I remember this one woman at one of our orientations. She said to me, well, what if I can't raise the money, right? That's your self-talk. What if I can't? What if I can't? What if I can't? And I said, you will. Yeah, but what if I can't? You will, but what if I can't? Look, you will. But if you can't, you can't go. That's it. You can't go. Yeah. I said, but if you make a commitment, you'll start to inspire people. Why don't you make a commitment right now that you're going to do it? And she did. And I said, great, I'm going to give you $100. See, if you left here on the fence, I would not have given you $100. She came up to me on the AIDS ride, 6 months later. Dan, you wouldn't believe it. I think the pledge minimum was $2,000, and she'd raised something like $3,800. And she had a completely different experience of herself and of what was that she was capable of. So that's what I mean. You know, the enemy is inside our heads. You know, nobody has ever said worse things about us than we've said about ourselves. And so when you see somebody overcome that, it's very powerful. And that's why I do the work that I do in the nonprofit sector, because I think the nonprofit sector has been sold a bill of goods that keeps them thinking very small. And I just love liberating people from that and opening their eyes to the notion that there is zero reason you can't dream as big as Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk. You know, there's no, what's the reason?
So your TED Talk on that point is so powerful in my opinion, so clearly right. Have you seen it starting to make inroads? How do you deal with the frustration of it's not being adopted as rapidly as, in my opinion, it should be?
There was a transcendentalist minister in Massachusetts who said the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And then Martin Luther King started using that phrase, and it got right. connected with him. But that's what I believe. Look, what we're talking about is what I want to do is change the way the donating public thinks about giving. Stop thinking that low overhead means you found a good charity. Stop thinking that a low salary for the CEO means you found a good charity. Start asking what good they're doing. When you find out what good they're doing, whether they're actually solving the problem, whether they're actually making a difference in people's lives, then you know that you found a good charity. That's going to take a long time to change that, because people have been taught to think that for hundreds of years. So I look at, you know, as I said, I'm gay. I look at the fact that when I came out in around 1980 to my parents, I was 19 years old. They were so depressed. You'll never have a family. You'll never have kids. You'll never have a normal life. You'll be ridiculed. Today, 40 years later, as a result of millions of people coming out and saying who they truly are, I'm married to a wonderful man. We have three beautiful children. My parents in their 80s have said that these kids have transformed their lives. And what a thing it is for the thing that you thought was the end of your life, in the end of my life in my 20s, becomes the beginning of yours in your 70s and your 80s. Things change, but it takes a long time. And I think on the arc of changing the way people think about charity, we're sort of at the where gay marriage was at the beginning, but things are beginning to change. You know, three of the big watchdog agencies, the Better Business Bureau and Charity Navigator and GuideStar, about 2 months after I gave that TED Talk, issued a press release telling the public that overhead is not the right thing to ask about, which was like hell freezing over. You now see foundations funding things other than overhead. So it's starting to change, but I don't kid myself. You know, it's going to be a long road.
And you talk a lot about real social innovation. Is that part of it, getting a different framework, understanding the benefits of scale, acting more aggressively towards the problem? What does that mean to you, real social innovation?
Well, typically, innovation might mean you bring a new idea to market. You know, the iPhone is an incredible innovation. The iPad, AirPods, you know, Tesla is a wonderful innovation. What I'm talking about is a kind of a more fundamental innovation in the very way we think about charity. As I said, you've been taught to think that when you got low overhead, you got a good charity. You've been taught to think not to pay people well in charity. But you want people to pay, you want the Red Sox to pay whatever it takes to find a pitcher who can win the World Series, right? Why wouldn't you want the American Cancer Society to pay whatever it takes to win the battle against cancer? Why would you think differently about that? So that's what I mean by innovation there, by really turning upside down this Puritan view that we have of charity. You know, you told me you're from Massachusetts. I'm from Massachusetts. This whole thing started here with the Puritans, came here to Salem in the 1630s, and they came here to make a lot of money. They also came here for religious reasons, but to make a lot of money. But you weren't supposed to make a lot of money, because that meant you were going to go directly to hell. So they had to figure out some way around that, and charity became the answer. I'll make a lot of money, but I'll give a little bit of it to charity, and that'll be my penance for making a lot of money. And so we grew up with this religion that charity should be deprived, that charity is the epicenter for self-deprivation, and it doesn't serve us anymore. That's not how we're going to end hunger. That's not how we're going to end veterans' homelessness. It's not how we're going to stop suicide. You know, we need enterprises as big as Home Depot and Apple and Coca-Cola. But if you tell charities you can't play by those same rules, you can't advertise the way Home Depot advertises. You can't pay people the way Home Depot pays people. You can't take the kinds of risk Home Depot takes. You can't have access to capital like Home Depot takes. Then there's not a chance in hell that they're going to ever end hunger or poverty or stop domestic violence or eradicate any of these problems. And we need them to dream at that level. Hey, come on. Apple is dreaming at the level of, I want to get a cell phone in everyone's hands. You, nonprofit sector, you have a right, you have an absolute right to dream your most beautiful dreams and to have the tools and the resources you need to make those come true.
Speaking of Home Depot and Coca-Cola and Martin Luther King, as we were preparing to come on for this podcast, you mentioned that you had been in Atlanta last weekend and that you had visited many of the significant sites here in Atlanta and then went to Memphis and went to Graceland. And you said you thought there were some interesting connections between Martin Luther King and Elvis. I said, that's an amazing thought. And so I want to follow up on that and ask you on air, what is the connection that you see?
Yeah, we took our kids on. We go on a road trip every spring, and we did country music and civil rights in Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama and Tennessee this time. And we went and saw the Ebenezer Baptist Church, and we went and saw the Lorraine Motel where Martin Luther King was shot, and we went to Graceland and the Country Music Hall of Fame. And you know what I found interesting? I don't want to equate their accomplishments in the world necessarily, but what was interesting is the simplicity of the times, and I don't mean that in a Pollyanna kind of make America great again way. They were very simple times. So, you know, Elvis lives in this housing project in Memphis, and there's this place called Sun Records down the street, and he can walk in the door and for $3.98 record a little record for his mother. And Sam Phillips, who runs the place, hears it and says, this kid's got a good voice. 2 or 3 weeks later, they record That's All Right. And within 6 weeks, this kid who was living in a housing project has international fame. You know, that's what I mean by the times were simple. So he became very famous at a young age. Martin Luther King as well, you know, he took the pastorship at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery at a young age. I think he was 24 or 25. He was just looking for a simple place to finish his dissertation and pastor a parish. And little did he know that the bus boycotts were sort of already in the works, and he was asked to lead the Montgomery Improvement Association and found himself in the center of the civil rights movement and on the covers of magazines at a very young age. What I found interesting was geographically how closely they grew up to one another. The time, you know, it was the late 50s. Their early meteoric rises to international celebrity. The fact that they both died in Memphis, the fact that they both have water features around their graves, I just thought it would have been interesting for Elvis and Martin Luther King to be high school friends. I wonder what they would have talked about, you know?
That's an amazing connective string and a really interesting question. And I'll just do one odd segue from that in terms of other things that I've read that you've talked about, which is the idea of love and its power and also how you see the destructive side of it. Some of the infighting you've seen in communities like nonprofits, you know, quote unquote, in the name of love. What have you learned about love, how people love one another, and what we can do to be more effective in channeling it?
Yeah, I think we're mostly driven by fear. Philanthropy comes from the Latin philos anthropos, love of humanity. And so I think in the nonprofit sector, we think we've got the love thing down way more than corporate America. I just don't think that's true because we have all kinds of things that distract us. You know, we have people that we don't like. We have job security issues. We have office politics. We have, you know, budget realities, all kinds of things that distract us from love. When I was in high school, I was a big John Denver fan when everybody else was listening to Zeppelin and Jethro Tull. And I loved the bells of his acoustic guitar and the way he played it. And he used to credit Werner Erhard and everyone in Est on his albums. And I thought, what is this thing? Because he's got a different sensibility about him. And it must have something to do with his Est thing. So I wrote to him and he sent me back a brochure. And my first weekend at Harvard, I did the YES training. And, you know, and lots of celebrities were doing it back then, and people were calling it a cult, and it was on the cover of magazines. And it was a profound experience and enlightenment for me. It was like getting Zen enlightenment over the course of 2 weekends. I don't know how they constructed it so that you were able to have that experience, but you saw the commonality in human beings. You saw that self-talk that I talked about earlier, that we all have this self-narrative that badgers us and punishes us and makes us suffer all day long. And we don't appreciate that we're all dealing with that. And I began to see at that early age that this is the answer. We're looking to politics for the answer, but the answer lies in the domain of being. Like, why isn't Congress in some kind of a conflict resolution workshop 4 times a year? Why aren't they on in therapy? Why aren't they on retreat regularly? You know, businesses work on their culture. Who works on the culture of Congress? Nobody. There's no Department of Culture for Congress. So you have this horrible culture. And we wonder why. Well, it's because we don't put any energy or effort into it. If I didn't put any effort into the culture of my family, I would have a horrible culture in my family. But I put a lot of effort into the culture of my family. So we've got our eyes on the wrong prize. It's like, well, who can win next? Who can win next? One of the reasons I'm actually excited about Marianne Williamson, who I used to see lecture all the time on A Course in Miracles, because she's enlightened, you know, and it's amazing and wonderful to see a serious, semi-serious, because she could be in the debates if she gets another 8,000 donors, contender for the presidency, who's talking about these kinds of things, about love as the foundation for what we do. Because we've seen, you know, if you're, I don't know how old you are, Frank, I'm 58 years old. You've been alive for 58 years. You've seen the pendulum swing back and forth, back and forth, back and forth enough to know that it doesn't really matter who gets elected. It's just going to be the same damn thing over and over again. The left will have power, the right will have power. The left will have power, the right will have power. There's a different domain where we need to start looking for the answers. And to me, it's love. And love in a rigorous way, you know, because love can be like sweet and kind and nice, and that's nice. But sometimes that can be backstabbing when you're being nice and you don't really want to be nice. You know, you really hate the person. I think bringing a kind of rigor of responsibility for your own thoughts and your own communication and your own perspective, that's what love really is to me, you know, is being rigorous about your judgments about other people, about the prisons in which you put other people in your mind. That's what real love is.
That is brilliant. And I have to say, having served in government, your comment on the culture and the need to pay attention to the culture, that needs to be your next TED Talk. People need to listen to that and change. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
So Dan, final question. Where are you do a lot of writing, you do talk to lots of different groups. Where's the best place for interested listeners to find out more about you?
Simple. Just go to danpilata.com. And if you go to danpilata.com, you can find out about the books I've written, speeches I'm giving, the Boulder board trainings that we do for nonprofit boards. I just wrote this fun little piece of humor, a rant about flying and God called Sky Problems. So you can learn about all that stuff at danpilata.com.
Well, thank you again. This has been a great privilege. Really appreciate your time.
Fun conversation, Frank. Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Dan Pilata. And I think you can tell from the discussion we had that it just scratched the surface of Dan's thought processes and all of the energy he brings to Crazy Good Turns. So thank you for listening, and I hope you go to his website, danpilata.com, to learn more about him and his efforts. Our show is recorded at Listen Up Studios in Atlanta, editing by Stephen Key and mixing by Score Score in Los Angeles. Special thanks to our production team of Brian Sabin and Megan Hanlon. Until next time, this is Frank Blake, thanking you for listening and celebrating another Crazy Good Turn.